Okay, those of you that were here earlier, you saw the Paramount movie Fire in the Sky, where something extremely unusual occurred on November 5th, 1975, in a forested area of northern Arizona. So we've seen Hollywood's version. But now, in a few minutes, you will hear the story as it actually happened. From the gentleman who lived through it and it, to a certain extent continues to live through it today. I remember I was speaking at UFO conferences following the publication of my book, Mexico's Roswell. And I happened to be at a UFO conference, the same one where Travis Walton was speaking. And I remember I was very busy getting my stuff ready, and I was scheduled to speak at some point. And I remember walking into the auditorium, and Travis had just begun speaking. I had never heard him before, and I was just transfixed. I actually stood there like a statue and listened. You know, probably insects could have gone in my open mouth. I was just amazed. Because one thing is to watch Hollywood's semi-fictionalized version of what happened, but another thing is to actually listen to the man himself tell you exactly what happened during the 5 days that he was aboard that craft and everything else associated with the story. So Travis has asked us to play a short little introductory video, and it's just about 12 minutes long. And after the video plays, he will be with us to talk about his personal experience.
You folks to meet the actors who portray Travis and Mike in the film. The other man I'm sure you'll recognize right off is perhaps best known for his hole in the head role opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 2. He's the cop who won't die but melts and gets split apart, everything else. But he's here and he's in one piece. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome D.B. Sweeney and Robert Patrick.
I think they like you.
This is Sergeant Reynolds from Criminal Investigations calling Lieutenant Frank Waters. Are you there, Lieutenant? Over.
Because it is true. Truth is a little stranger than fiction, as they say. And this is a good, solid script. And I like the boys. The boys are good. You know, it's their picture, and I'm just kind of supporting them. But I like it.
To really relate to Travis and Mike, you and DB had to learn how to be loggers and...
Yeah, we were with the chainsaws out there logging, and I actually nearly took out a bunch of crew guys. I was supposed to aim it at the camera this way, and the lights and everything were here, and crew guys were here. And this is a huge tree, and I had it going, and I thought I had it aimed the right way, and next thing I know, it's going towards all these guys, and they're all running, they're screaming at me.
Can't hear you.
the whole energy of the cast came together pretty quickly. The first or second day we were in the room together, you could sort of look around, and, you know, oh, there's Craig Sheffer, yeah, he's Dallas, and Robert Patrick was already well into his thing, and it fell together very nicely.
Hey. Hey, bud.
We said we'd do a little fishing when the contract's over.
When this contract's over, yeah.
Come on, it's what we need, one of our camping trips. Some hunting, some fishing, chasing bears.
Oh, yeah, I remember. You ran that bear up that tree.
Just trying to make friends.
So how come you can't make friends with Dallas?
He's just jealous I can do something he can't.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
Reading, right?
Oh, I just play a sheriff. Who is a real character, Sheriff Waters, and he doesn't believe a word they say. He just doesn't believe in UFOs, and also he's never had a case he didn't solve, and it really gets to him because he's going to have one he can't solve, and it really bothers him. He doesn't believe a word about any UFOs.
You expect me to believe that a flying saucer came down and took your friend away to outer space?
That's the truth, mister. That's exactly what happened.
Is it? Is it?
And you know that, Blake. Why the heck aren't you speaking up for us? Why let this man talk to us like this?
David, I will.
It seems like you're not even trying to believe us. We all saw the thing. We all saw the guy get zapped.
How about you, Mr. Dallas? You go along with that?
Oh, yeah, I go along with that.
You don't sound too sure.
Well, I'm sure.
Why don't you fellas tell Lieutenant Waters what you saw? Or what you think you saw?
It was the house that saw first.
What about it?
Tell us about it. What'd you see? What did it look like?
It looked like a fire.
Stop, Mike! Stop the truck!
Travis!
Travis!
You son of a bitch!
What the hell are you doing? Get back in the truck, asshole!
Travis, whatever were you thinking about, boy?
Well, you'd have to know me back then.
What, a hellraiser? Yeah,
well, you know, I can explain what he did. You know, about three months before this happened, we had another little experience. He jumped out of the truck to chase a bear that ran across the road. And if you can explain that, you can explain this.
I'm not like that anymore. They're saying get back in the truck, and that was just kind of egging me on. I was scared too, but...
Hey, Mike!
Travis, get out of there! You feel that? Travis! Get this!
Get the hell out of here!
Get back in there! Travis!
It's incredible experience playing these guys, I'll tell you.
Some of these loggers came back.
Mm-hmm.
One did not. You did not.
I played
your
Travis
character.
Walton.
Right.
I see the UFO, I get out of the truck, and just after what we just saw, I get zapped by a bolt of light, and I'm knocked unconscious. The other guys think I'm dead, and they take off, and then Mike realizes I've left my best friend there, I gotta go back, and he comes back about 5 minutes later, and I'm gone without a trace.
The other loggers did not know what had happened to Travis,
no,
right?
Actually, we're all in the truck just going home from a work day. And we see it. We all see it. He wants to get a closer look and walks out underneath it. So the other guys that are with us in the crew cab, they all see it as well.
Yeah.
So we have like six witnesses.
Right.
And then as DB said, I go back with the guys and we look for him. He's gone.
And in real life, this group went back and reported him missing,
yeah.
Maybe even dead.
Yeah, yeah. We knew he was missing. We thought he was dead. And we went back to the town and we explained to him what had happened. We knew that it was, it's a wild story, but we're sharing it with them, and they didn't want to hear it.
We've been telling you the truth since the beginning, and now we're ready to prove it. We'll take your damn lie detector test. You set it up. We'll be there. You go ahead. And if any of you got anything to say about me or my crew, you say it now. And you say it to my face.
Are you saying, Phil, that all seven of these people are lying?
I'm afraid we have to say that on the basis of physical evidence.
Meaning?
Physical evidence that should have been there, but was not. Now, you heard Travis and Mike Rogers claim that this beam from the UFO was like a grenade exploding, fire, flame, that Travis was knocked 10 feet back, and in his book he claims he hit his shoulder against the rock. When the morning after this incident allegedly occurred, when the law enforcement officers went to the site to inspect, they found all kinds of dry pine needles, which, if this had actually happened, those needles would have been blasted away, they would have caught fire, they would have burned.
Why are you laughing, Travis?
Well, because this is typical of the sort of reasoning pattern this man uses in attacking all UFO cases. He's equating the absence of evidence to be the evidence of absence. That's absurd, you know, and that's actually a logical fallacy.
It's necessary for people to know just exactly what Philip Klass really is, who he really is. He's nothing more than a disinformation specialist from Washington, D.C.
Well, what's the word?
The results of one of the tests. Unusual. It's inconclusive. We'll have to try again tomorrow.
What about the other ones? What's the word on them?
The process is still ongoing. We never discuss the results till all the testing is complete.
Sorry, fellas. Come back down here in the morning, 9:00 sharp.
No.
What?
I said no. Look, we did what we said we'd do. We came in here like guinea pigs and let you test us, but that's it. We've had enough.
I ain't coming back again.
You're saying that you're no longer willing to cooperate.
That's all we do is cooperate. And all we get back from you is grief.
Mike, we need a little bit of time.
No, Mike, I'm sick of this shit. You want to press charges? You go ahead. You do it now. We told you everything we know. And if that's not good enough, that's too damn bad. Because that's all there is. Let's get the hell out of here.
What are you saying, son?
Well, Blake, my charts don't lie. You ask me, those boys are telling the truth.
I think we can be rather certain that this incident occurred, that they're not lying. What they claim happened did happen, and it's not a hoax.
The fact that I have to make the audience believe this extraordinary thing has actually happened to me, and if I can do that, it'll be a great victory for me, because it's not a matter of getting them to believe that your dog died or that your car won't start or that you broke up with your girlfriend. It's asking them to believe something quite extraordinary, you know, of biblical proportions. And that was what initially got my attention when I read the script, that central challenge of making, we're not making a special effects supernatural movie. We're making a movie about ordinary people where something extremely extraordinary happens.
You know, Robert, what about you? Are you a UFO believer, generally?
Well, if I can believe I'm a Terminator, I think I can believe this. I've had the theory, I think that Carl Sagan said it best, that we'd have to at least, you know, we can't be that arrogant not to consider that there could be something else out there. So I came into it like that. And then after I met Mike and Travis and talked to them at length about what they had experienced, I totally believed their story.
You do?
Totally.
So you believe that there are creatures out there who are far advanced technologically over us and even come and visit time to time?
I believe that these guys went through a very traumatic experience. I believe what they've told me. And as I said, going into the movie, I've always had the idea that it is a small universe. And we are a tiny speck, so we have to at least be open-minded enough to consider the probability.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like everybody to give a warm South Texas welcome to a gentleman who went through a lot of airports and a lot of plane flights from northern Arizona to be with us today, Mr. Travis Walton.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you being here. The movie really does leave us with the same kind of emotional impact that we went through back when we lived through all this. But as you, most of you probably know, Hollywood never sticks strictly to real life stories. I think it would really, you know, in all fairness to them, it would be very difficult to tell most real life stories exactly the way they really happen. You know, they're trying to do in 90 minutes something that took a number of years to happen. So it has its limitations, but at the same time, I think it did some good. It was the first time that Hollywood was willing to do a full-length movie about a real-life incident. And I think it really did open up people's minds in their willingness to take a look at the facts. And that was really my goal in agreeing to do the movie in the first place. It wasn't something that happened overnight. It took like 6 years with, you know, various studios looking like they were going to take it on and then not going forward with it. And but when we finally got the green light, you know, I still had misgivings about whether this was something I wanted or not, because, you know, I'd turned down a number of offers before talking to the Tracy Torme. But he was the first one that had done his homework, had, you know, thoroughly studied the case, talked to everybody involved, the sheriff, the other crew members. And he persuaded me that they weren't going to sensationalize it. And he did his best to keep that promise. But he's only the screenwriter. You know, once the director gets involved, he has a say. The producers have a say. The studio has a say. And each thing that signs on gains a little more power over the end product. So right after the movie came out, a lot of people were very angry at me about the fictionalizations that happened in the movie. But, you know, I was powerless to affect that. When I saw things in the script that I, you know, didn't feel good about, I wrote some letters to the producers, and their reply was rather dismissive. You know, I realized I really didn't have any power to affect it at all. So I tried to make the most of it. And all in all, it was something that, you know, I'm glad happened, but still looking for a remake that'll tell it more like it really happened. I don't expect it to ever be like a documentary. I understand that, you know, there are certain abbreviations that are necessary. Like in the movie, there's a character named Don. I mean, a character named Dan, who is really playing both of my brothers, Don and Dwayne. And so I don't want to get too much into going through point by point where the movie departed from what really happened. I'll just tell you how it was that day. The movie's got five of us out there. There was actually seven. And we just finished work. We'd been putting in some long days. We were trying to, you know, get as much done before the weather shut us out of the woods. And so we loaded our equipment into the truck and we're headed out of there. In the movie, it gives the impression we had, you know, been driving for some time and everybody's kind of dozing off. But we'd just recently been doing this vigorous physical exercise. We were all in a very alert state of mind. And the smokers were in the back seat and they were just lighting up and all these little conversations go on amongst the crew. We're driving down the road, bouncing along, everybody joking. And one by one, these little conversations started to go silent. So I assumed that, you know, they were catching sight of what caught my attention. I saw these little points of glimmers of light coming through the trees ahead. And it was definitely something out of the ordinary. This is, you know, a darkening forest and, you know, there's really not supposed to be anything there. But we had heard some shots in the distance and knew that it was deer hunting season. So that was my first explanation that came to mind, that, you know, maybe there were some deer hunters camped up there on the ridge. And but, you know, there was just something not right about that. We were going south, kind of uphill. There was this, we were paralleling the edge of this ridge, and the crest of the ridge was to our right. And so, you know, the light was coming from higher than where we were, but at the same time, it wasn't that, you know, it was higher than where the ground level would have been. So I thought, not campers, you know. And, you know, they probably wouldn't have thought that camping near a bunch of chainsaw noise would have been a good place to camp. So, you know, that didn't pan out. And since it was higher up, I was thinking about a crashed plane hanging up in a tree, and found out, you know, later that Dwayne Smith, one of the crewmen, was thinking along the same lines. But in the past, we had been driving to work and we would see a tree that had been hit by lightning, you know, with some flames still there, and we stopped and put the fire out, because the Mogollon Rim area there in northern Arizona has the highest number of lightning strikes of any place in the continental United States, except for the Everglades. So we thought it might be a fire, and that's where the name Fire in the Sky came from. But the closer we got, the more that wasn't adding up, and all these little glimmers, and there was just something kind of odd about this glow. And so pretty soon, you know, the crew was saying, what's that, you know? And I said, Mike, hurry up, get up there, because, you know, you could see up ahead where there was a break in the trees and the light was sort of shining across the road. So, you know, that was where the clearing was. And when we got to where that little path of light was, bam, there it was. I yelled out, stop the truck, Mike. And about the same time, Alan in the back yelled out, it's a flying saucer, because there it was, unmistakable, less than 100 feet away, you know, probably closer than from here to the back of the room. And, you know, this is... some of the skeptics were saying, oh, those guys didn't see a UFO. They just saw the planet Jupiter off in the sky. That's the reason they passed lie detector tests. But, you know, this was a clearly defined metallic disc, had glowing panels on it, and hovering there outlined against the sky, totally unmistakable. But as the truck stopped, I was just thinking it's going to take off. You know, many times... we've been driving through the woods and we'll catch sight of an animal and one of us will and call out to the others, look, there's a bobcat or whatever. And before the others can even look, it's just gone. So that was kind of my impression with this UFO. I was just thinking when I got out of the truck and headed towards it, that it would just be gone before I got that close. Now, later in an interview with Hard Copy, Alan Dallas said that it looked to him like I was just being drawn towards it, you know. And I took issue with that, but Steve Pearson, the youngest guy in the crew, said, no, I think you were in some kind of trance. But it didn't feel that way to me, you know. I just felt like I just wanted to see it up close before it got away. But, you know, and then other people argue, well, if they were controlling you, they would just make you think it was your idea. So... whatever the case was, I just came towards it, wanting to see it. And then as I got closer, the sound it was making just, you know, it was a little scarier the closer I got. And there was this feeling. And, you know, Mike and some of the other crewmen said that it seemed like something was about to happen. And I'm thinking that what that caused that feeling was that there was a kind of like an electrical charge building up in the craft. Because when I got up close to it, the sound got louder and it started to move upward. So, you know, that kind of startled me. And I jumped down into a crouch, but the closest cover was this log that was sticking up out of this pile of debris, logging debris there. And I crouched down behind the log. And they kept yelling at me to get back in the truck and swearing at me, get out of there, get the hell out of there. And so, you know, I didn't really need to be told. I was already thinking that I'd gotten myself into a, you know, a dangerous situation there. So I decided to run back to the truck. So I raised up and turned to go. But right when I straightened up, bam, that's when it hit me. And let me get the slides going here. I almost forgot about those. But, you know, oh, don't tell me. I hit the wrong button. A little help here. I hit that bottom button you told me not to hit. Anyway, I just felt this shock go through my body. And it was just kind of a numbing sort of, it felt kind of like an electrical shock or like I'd physically been hit. And Dwayne Smith, one of the other crewmen, said, and he later became an electrician, so he said it sounded to him like high voltage. And in one of the police reports, one of the crewmen described it as looking like a long blue flame. But another crewman said it looked like a laser beam, you know, just a shaft of energy. And lightning bolt, you know, whatever their descriptions, it was just a really powerful blast. You know, they said it looked like I'd stepped on a landmine, like a grenade had gone off. So the movie portrayed this in a very tepid sort of way. You know, they actually downplayed it, which, you know, isn't what you'd expect Hollywood to do. You'd think that they would exaggerate any time they had a chance to put on a light show or show some pyrotechnics. But instead, they just have this little light shine on the actor and hold him for a minute and toss him back. But it wasn't like that. It was just this blast that happened all at once and just threw me back through the air. You know, I said 10 feet, Steve, you know, he's in the lower right there. He insisted that it was more like 20 feet. And he was probably in the best position of anybody in back in the truck because he was sitting near on the door side towards the thing. And he never took his eyes off of it. So there's a Mike in the upper left. He was driving the truck. Ken Peterson, he was in the middle in the front. And then me, we're sitting by the door. And then Alan was in the back along with Dwayne Smith in the lower left there. He was 6'7" or something like that, a really tall guy. And then the guy in the middle there is John Gallette. And then Steve Pierce in the lower right. He was played by Henry Thomas in the movie, who you might have noticed was actually the little boy in the movie E.T., all grown up. But Mike was the crew boss, was played by Robert Patrick, who was the liquid metal man in Terminator. But Alan Dallas was played by Craig Sheffer, who I think did a really good job. You know, a lot of ad-libbing in what he did there. Anyway, me back then. Then the truck that we were driving. And that's what we saw, you know, and this is kind of from my perspective, looking up at it right before I was hit. And I just, you know, was at first just standing there just in awe of this, you know. And John Gillette describes this as looking like some powerful sports car, you know, just really, just real impressive and actually beautiful in a scary kind of way. But when that beam hit me, they thought it killed me. Immediately they started yelling, it killed him, it got him, you know. When Steve Pearce said it got him, he means got him like it got a deer, you know. He's dead. And that's what their thinking was. And that's why they were screaming to the driver, get us out of here. And a lot of people hearing all that said, oh, yeah, a bunch of real heroes there, you know, and basically insinuating that these guys were cowardly to take off at that point. But, you know, they saw what they thought killed me. You know, they thought they just saw somebody get killed. And they described to me how they drove down the road like crazy, you know, crashing into trees and nearly wrecking the truck to get away from there. And then they stopped and started screaming about what happened. And Steve says that Dwayne Smith said he disintegrated. It knocked him to pieces, you know. And Steve told him, no, I kept my eyes on him, and I saw him hit the ground in one piece. So that increased the odd idea that, you know, maybe if they did return, maybe I was just hurt, that they were, you know, that it was worth trying to stage a rescue. And so I got to give these guys credit. They did go back. They thought they'd just seen somebody get killed. They thought they might be next. They had no weapons. And yet they had the courage to go back to try to see if they could rescue me. So I find no fault with what those guys did. And a lot of people think, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. I'd be out there where Travis was. But, you know, I shouldn't have been doing what I did. That was a mistake. But when they approached the site coming back, they saw it lift up and streak off towards the northeast. That helped, you know, restore a little confidence about, you know, and the closer they got to where it was, there was a little bit of searching to make sure they found the spot. But when they'd taken off, you know, the tires on the truck had really spun and dug out. So they knew that spot. And then when they stopped, they could see my tracks going up into the clearing there. But for a minute there, they were too scared to get out. They only had one flashlight. So they said they were, you know, all just huddled real close around this one flashlight, you know, just shoulder to shoulder. Steve says he was doing his best to stay in the middle of the group, you know. But, you know, here these, you know, big tough loggers are all huddled around the light. But you know, I don't blame them. They, as they moved through searching and calling, occasionally they'd catch a glimpse of the moon through the trees, and it was similar in color to the glow of the craft, and that startled them. But, you know, the quiet woods in the dark and, you know, doing the searching, you know, took a lot of courage for what they were doing. But when they didn't, you know, find me after a while, Ken says that Mike, you know, fell to his knees and started crying. And Steve says bawling like a baby, but I'll tell you why he said that, you know, because they decided to go back to town. And they went in and they argued about what to do on the way back. And they said, we got to go get the authorities. And Alan Dallas says, no way, don't get the police, you know. He didn't want to, he's always been a black sheep, been in trouble with the law. And he said, we'll just go get some friends and get some guns. And then if we can't find him, then we'll go tell the sheriff. And then Ken says, well, you know, if we don't go tell him what happened and Travis never found, how's that going to look? We got to go. So It was actually Ken who made the phone call, not Mike, in, like in the movie. So Ken calls the sheriff, and the sheriff's deputy comes down, and you know, our coworker, he's missing, he might be dead, and oh, might be dead. And then they start getting all suspicious. And so the deputy calls the sheriff, and he comes down with his second in command, and they start interviewing the guys. And right off the bat, they're suspecting that this was a cover story for a murder. You know, they figure one of the crew killed me, and the others were covering it up for some reason. So, but Steve was still crying. And some of the others were so shook up, you know, that the sheriff was certain that something real had happened, but he figured it was a murder. And that's what really got Steve so upset. When my first book came out and it described, you know, how he was one of the ones that was still crying, he got real mad. He came over to my house. He was going to fight, you know, because his cousins were teasing him about it. And, you know, it's taken all this time for me to halfway convince him that there's no shame in that. He's a 17-year-old kid, and he just saw somebody get killed or thought he did. And so there was no shame in the fact that he was crying. So that's the reason he's emphasizing that Mike was crying. It's because he was crying too. So, you know, the sheriff, you know, unlike in the movie, they did go back that night, and he got half of the crew to go with him, and the other half took the truck back to the town. And the sheriff, second in command, he was an expert tracker, and they didn't find anything. The tracks went to the middle of the clearing, and that was it. But the real search began the next day. They got over 50 men on horseback and on four-wheel drive vehicles. They wound up including airplanes and helicopters, and they even brought tracking dogs out, and the dogs, you know, followed the trail up to the middle of the clearing, and that's where it ended. So during the search, the men were back at the clearing, which was kind of, you know, where the incident happened, but it was kind of the base for the search. They spread out, you know, each man within sight of the other, and made these great big sweeps through the forest looking for every sign. And the crew, the guys that were there, noticed that there was a guy dressed in a Forest Service uniform and with a Geiger counter. And apparently these men were finding radiation. But when the crew went over there and said, "You find anything?" "Oh, no, there's nothing here." So that's just background. See, 1.5 everywhere. And then he said, here's real radiation. And he held it up to this guy's radium dial watch, and he got a 3. And so he said, "Well, test us." So he tested the crew, and it was still 1.5. But Mike said, "Well, we've bathed and changed our clothes since then, but you know, we still got our hard hats in the truck." So they went back over to the truck and got the hard hats. And when he tested that, it went all the way up to 6, which was double that of the radium dial watch. But instead of testing further, the guy just gets this look on his face and just angrily rolls it up and stomps off. So that was kind of a strange situation. That was being Forest Service contractors, you know, Mike figured he knew all the local Forest Service guys, but he'd never seen that guy before. So whether he was really Forest Service or who sent him or what he really found, that was kind of a mystery. When I went back there winter before last with the National Geographic, they brought a Geiger counter. They were going to check for radiation. I was eager to retest it. Only when we get there do they say, "This isn't going to do any good because there's 2 feet of snow here and water blocks the radiation that we're looking for." So that's still something I'm going to follow up on this summer. That'll all be documented. But they were also standing at the clearing, and this Forest Service guy comes up to Dwayne Smith, grabs him by the shirt front, and jerks him up close and says, all right, where'd you hide the body? And, you know, John Gillette explains that all the crew members that were present that were involved in the search, the sheriff put a deputy with each one of them, followed them around the whole day, just pushing at them, saying, come on, tell us what really happened. Who was it that, maybe it wasn't you, come on. Maybe Alan killed Travis, and you don't need to get yourself involved here. You know, you don't need to be covering for him. Tell us what really happened. We can all go home here. But the men said, no, that's not what happened. And so when this guy grabbed Dwayne Smith, my brother was also named Dwayne, says, hey, knock it off. You know, so the guy goes leaving. But the men said, we'll take lie detector tests, sodium pentothal, anything you want. We're telling the truth. So the sheriff heard about that and arranged for the state police lie detector expert to come in and test the guys. So they were told to show up at the courthouse, which was actually also the jail. And so there was a lot of fear on the part of these guys that that this would be rigged, that the tests would be designed to prove that they had killed me. With a way that the sheriff had of calming the community and telling them, it's okay, folks, nothing to see here, go on, you know, just to put closure on it. They killed him, they buried him, we'll never find the body. But when the testing was over and the examiner told the sheriff, these boys are telling the truth, sheriff didn't really want to accept it, which is kind of ironic, because had the lie detector man said, yep, Alan killed him, they all helped bury him or whatever, no problem. They would have been sent to jail right then, no doubt about it. But if they saw a UFO, well, you know, something else happened here. It's really strange how, you know, even if six people saw somebody commit a murder and didn't take lie detector test, that's a conviction right there, off to the electric chair. So kind of a uneven treatment of the evidence, and it's not just the sheriff. It's a lot of people ever since this happened. So when I was hit by that beam, I didn't see what happened. I just felt, a kind of a burst of energy kind of a thing, but it was more like just a numbing shock, kind of like an electrical shock or a physical blow, and I blacked out. So when I flew through the air and hit the ground, I was all unconscious. When I woke up, it was all just pain, and I didn't just come to real quickly. I was in and out of consciousness for quite some time and struggling to breathe. You know, I knew something was terribly, terribly wrong here. I didn't really know where I was at first. And then I remembered. I remembered approaching the object, and I figured something happened. I'd been hurt somehow, and that I'd been taken to the hospital. So I thought I was in a hospital. There was some, I knew I was on some kind of a raised gurney or operating table of some kind, because the ceiling was so close to me and there was this light above me. And it was only when I could finally focus my eyes that I saw these creatures standing over me. And then I knew for sure, you know, I was definitely not in a hospital and I was in deep trouble. I just freaked out immediately. And even though I was so weak, I could hardly move, you know, I managed to move enough to push, or I tried to hit it away, but it was just more of a shove than anything. It was lighter than I expected, weak as I was, and it fell back into the other one. And I rolled away from it at the same time, and this thing that was across my chest fell off. But I was mainly just focused my attention on them. And I backed away and was screaming just hysterically, you know, get back, stay away from me. And they came around the table towards me. And as I backed up, I bumped into this shelf or a workbench or something behind me. And I just looked real quickly to just grab something to defend myself with. And there was all these instruments laid out there. But I just grabbed the biggest thing there that I could swing at them, which is not, it's cut off on the top of this picture, but I was holding up this long glass or plastic tube or rod and swinging it at them, you know, with a striking motion. They weren't close enough to hit, but they stopped short of that. And they all three stared at me there for a few seconds that seemed like forever. And those eyes just penetrated into me in the most disturbing kind of way. You know, it's just really hard to describe the feeling that gave me, this feeling of invasion of something really, really... I definitely did not want something very threatening, you know. But I was thinking of how I was going to fight my way past them, because the only opening was this doorway behind them. And so before I could move towards them, they just suddenly turned and went out the door. And there was a little passageway out there, and they went to the right. So I went to the doors, and this was all very dimly lit, very cramped, very claustrophobic. And this diagram that I've got here is just what I pieced together later. I didn't know where I was. I was very disoriented and breathing, struggling to breathe. I just couldn't get enough air. And, you know, my loss of control and my out-of-control fear was just over the top. But I think it was more than just my situation. It was the fact that when I woke up, I was in a lot of pain. You know, the feeling that I knew I was mortally wounded, you know, very, very bad feeling inside. And but more than any of that is the feeling of suffocation. Waterboarding on terrorists is so effective that even though these people are trained that it's coming and you know, to expect it and how to resist it, it works anyway, because the feeling of suffocation works on a level beneath reasoning. You know, it's something beyond our control that reaches a level of fear that is on the instinctive level. That you can't think it away. You can't reason it away. And so that, I think, was what, you know, caused this fear to erupt so out of control. And whether that feeling of suffocation came from the fact that the atmosphere wasn't right, or had something to do with the energy that hit me in the head and chest and caused some injury that way, it was something that just triggered fear that was just like nothing I've ever experienced in my life. And so I wasn't thinking clear. I was just had this idea that if I could just find a door, open it, I could just jump out and I'd be back in the woods where I was. But, you know, now knowing what I know now, it probably was not in the woods. And had I opened a door, you know, that would have been unlikely. I could have ever managed to do such a thing, not understanding how things worked there. But, you know, it probably wouldn't have been a very good thing at all. But, you know, and looking for doors out in places where I was, it wouldn't have opened outward anyway. But like I said, I was just not thinking very clear at all. It was just total fight or flight kind of a situation. So I'm in this little tight, dimly lit passageway, and I'm thinking that these creatures might be behind me, but the curve was such a tight curve that I couldn't see very far behind me, and I couldn't see very far ahead of me. So I didn't know if they were catching up to me, and I didn't know if I was running into something worse. So it left me with this horrible feeling, you know, not knowing whether to run or not, but still running anyway. And I actually went past a doorway on my left before I got a little bit more of a control and came to the doorway on my right. I looked into this room, which at first just seemed to be pretty empty except for the chair in there. But when I moved into the room is when it would darken, and there were stars all around. But from the doorway, I could see rectangles around the walls that I thought would probably be doors. So I was trying to figure out a way to open those when I moved into the room, and it would darken with these points of light coming into view. And somehow the viewing this map or viewing screen of where it was at the time, whichever it was, could best be seen from the position of the chair, but not really very visible from any place near the walls or doors. But I moved over to the doors and tried to see if there was some kind of a button to open it or a doorknob or anything, but there was nothing. And I tried to look in the crack of the door, but I couldn't see any light or feel any air coming through there. So I went over to this chair, and I started pushing the buttons on the right arm, and none of those had any effect on the door. As a matter of fact, they didn't really seem to do anything. We didn't have touch screen in those days, so it never occurred to me to touch the screen to see if that did anything. But it was green, glowing green, and had these little black lines on it with little segments on them. And some of the buttons would make those lines move and change angles, but there was no characters like numbers or letters. So none of that was opening a door, and so I decided to try the lever. And that caused all these stars to move at the same time, not relative to each other, but the whole thing moved at once. And it gave me the sensation for a second there that everything was tipping, but it wasn't. As a matter of fact, I never felt any movement in the floor or anything at all. It was just a real disoriented feeling to have these points of light, which are kind of your reference for standing up, suddenly move. So I decided I better not mess with that anymore. And I was thinking of pushing another button, and something caught my attention. And from the door I'd come through, and I see this man standing there, and I immediately assumed that it was somebody there to rescue me. He looked like a human being, did not look like one of these little humanoids that I'd seen earlier. And so I just came towards him, you know, telling him about these creatures. You got to get me out of here. I was just babbling, really. And he didn't respond, but that didn't trouble me too much at the moment, because he was wearing this helmet, and I thought maybe he couldn't hear me with that on or couldn't speak with it on. So when he just wanted me to come with him and sort of took me by the arm, I was only too happy to go if we're getting out of here. He didn't seem to be scared like me, and that was very encouraging. And so we went out through what I take to be kind of an airlock thing. It was just this little passageway where one door closed and the other one opened. And then we came out into this brightly lit area. It seemed bright, really, to where it hurt my eyes. But it was a lot cooler and easier to breathe. And down this ramp, which really seemed much steeper than it ought to be. But I was pretty unstable on my feet, still not well balanced. And I tried to look around, but he was kind of rushing me along. But I know there was some other craft in there, disc-shaped, but more rounded and shinier. But I really had to pay attention just to keep from falling down, because he seemed to be in such a hurry. And this was a big room, a huge room, kind of like an airplane hangar. And the wall that we were walking towards was vertical, but the ceiling curved down to form another wall behind us. And that curved surface was these lighted panels that were giving off this light that was a lot like sunlight. So I don't know if these were like translucent windows where sunlight was just shining on them and coming through, or some sort of an artificial light source that was made to look like sunlight. But it was really bright and a lot fresher, and I felt a lot of relief coming out of there. But he took me out of this big hangar, like, I don't know whether it was part of a larger craft or a building somewhere, but he there was some doors there. We went through down this hallway, and he left me with these other people, and he put me in this chair and then left. But they didn't have any helmets on, so you know, I had enough, barely enough brains left to think, well, they're, you know, they're not wearing the helmets, they can answer my questions. So I started in with the same thing: where am I, what are you guys doing with me, what are these creatures, you know, get me out of here, where am I, you know, every kind of thing like that. But again, no answer. So now, because I knew they could hear me, you know, I'm starting to say, whoa, wait a minute, what's going on? Is this really a rescue or not? So they're trying to take me over to the table, and they're trying to get me to lay down on the table. And I said, wait a minute, you know, just answer, just tell me, where am I, you know? I just kept screaming, and but they weren't, you know, affected by what I was saying at all. And I know they could hear me because when they were wrestling me down, I could see a little wince when I was really loud in what I was screaming. But the expression didn't seem real angry or aggressive or anything like that. There was just this faint, tolerant, sort of slightly annoyed look, you know, like a kid throwing a tantrum or something, you know. But they're trying to force me down, but there was three of them, and they were so much stronger than me, two men and a woman, that, and I was so weakened, you know, I was lucky to be able to stand up. But in spite of that, my fear, I was able to get one hand loose, and I got my finger under the edge of the mask. They put this mask on my face, and I started to pull it away. But before I could, boom, I was out. I worked with the artist, did a lot of drawings to get as close as what I could. It's like working with a police sketch artist. He kind of got overdone with their bodies, but as far as the face is concerned, pretty darn close, but there was just something odd about the eyes I never could quite ever put my finger on. But interesting that the female had a longer hair and the man, you know, like probably what current hairstyles would have been in the 70s. So that's one thing that made me assume they were from Earth, but there was something really odd about them. So, you know, right now I don't think they were from Earth. You know, I think maybe the hairstyles had to do with some kind of effort to blend in, that they maybe were here with the idea of moving amongst Earth people. When I regained consciousness, it wasn't slow and it wasn't painful or anything. I just came to. It was cold air, and I was lying face down, but my head was on my arm, not on the pavement. And there was a light above me, so I just looked to see where the light was coming from. But it went off just as I looked. So I don't know whether a light was turned off or a hatch closed or maybe some other glowing thing just quit glowing. Whatever it was, I'm looking at it for a few seconds there without any light, just hovering there in the dark, and then it just shot straight up into the sky. It didn't turn on edge. It just stayed with the bottom towards me and then just went straight up. And it moved so fast and was out of sight so fast, you'd think it would make a whooshing sound or a sound barrier sound, you know, but it was silent. It kind of moved the air a little bit, and I could feel a little bit of warmth. But other than that, But the main thing for me was this feeling of freedom, fresh air, cold, and, you know, the woods. And, you know, to me, that's my environment. It's where I worked every day, you know. So that felt like escape right at that moment. But I looked around and I recognized this stretch of road is leading down into Heber, the town nearest where this happened. And so that kind of renewed my energy a bit, and I took off running, you know, sort of fearful of being retaken, but desperate about, you know, the memory of these creatures and what I just experienced. You know, I just had this lingering, overpowering fear. It was psychological trauma, really deep. I went down into the town, banged on the door, and nobody came. I moved on down across the bridges and found a row of telephone booths and went into the first one. There was one on the right there, and it was out of order. And that was the last of my strength. But when I moved into the middle one, it worked. And I called my brother-in-law, and he thought it was a joke. Family had been getting crank calls over the previous days, and he started to hang up on me. Had a real sarcastic tone and said, I think you got the wrong number. But I screamed that it was me, and I somehow managed to convince him it was me. And he said, okay, I'll get your brother and come and get you. But, you know, I collapsed then, and I must have lost consciousness or something, because it seemed like, boom, they were there. But, you know, it took them at least half an hour, 45 minutes. I mean, I really don't have any memory of that. But come to find out later that the operator had listened in on that phone call and notified the sheriff. And I mentioned that. Sheriff sent a man out there. But got there after my family did. So it in response to the allegation that our famous UFO skeptic there was saying that I was never there at all, that I was off somewhere else. He had several theories, you know. But anyway, to this day, those phone booths are there. They're not hooked up to anything anymore. But they're just, because the phone company knew it really happened and what happened there, they've left them there. And there, you know, there aren't any phone booths anywhere else in the entire area. So my family took me and put me in the truck, and I was trying to tell my brother what happened, and I was just sobbing and just could hardly speak. And he said something that about what had been happening over those previous days. And what? You know, he said, and he could understand for some reason that I thought this was still the same night, because I could remember so little. But he said, Travis, you've been gone for 5 days. Feel your face. And I felt 5 day growth of beard, and I looked at my watch, and the date had changed. And you know, as trivial as that might seem in comparison to the rest of my experience, that was like the last straw, and I just couldn't talk anymore. Just, what, all this time, you know? But the family had been through a lot. It was already world news. Sheriff tried to keep these searchers, you know, to keep a lid on the news, but come to find out, they'd told, and there was already media crews from England and Japan there, stomping through the flower beds and taking pictures through my mom's front window and through Steve's bedroom window and following the crew around and generally harassing everybody. So there was also these calls that I was talking about. There were some that were taken seriously. One call was from this lady that said that she had been a nurse working in a hospital, and this old couple had come in, and they just had an encounter with some kind of object, and She left, and when she came back on shift the next day, the couple was gone, the records were gone, and the rest of the staff were just acting like, no, this never happened. So she said, just watch out who gets a hold of him if he should ever be found. And another guy called and said that he was a former CIA. He seemed rational and sincere, and gave left contact information and said the same thing, watch out about who gets a hold of him or he could, you know, disappear. So my brother did not think, well, let's get this guy to the sheriff. The town was a madhouse. Everything was crazy, and I was in a very fragile condition. And the only thing my brother was concerned with was getting me checked out medically, and that would have been really hard in that area because of all the hysteria that was going on. People were just, you know, please explain this away any way you can. So he took me to Phoenix right then, and during the search, he'd been approached by this UFO investigative group, and, which was sort of represented in the movie, you know, the wacko ones looking for a urine sample. And they had told my brother, you know, keep the first voided urine and bring it in for medical testing. He said, we've got this doctor in our membership. We'll have him checked out. And so that was my brother's whole reason to take me to Phoenix. So he took us over there to this so-called medical doctor, and, you know, as unsophisticated as we were, we didn't take us long to figure out that this guy's no doctor, you know. Even looking at the urine sample, he acted like, ew, you know, get away from here, you know. So he was claiming to the media that he was a medical doctor, and then they pushed him on that. And then he said, well, I was a medic in the Marine Corps, you know. And then later on, Mike called up and interviewed him again. He says, no, I was never in the Marine Corps. You know, even though that was on video, I was in the Navy, medic in the Navy. So changing his story, but he was a total quack. You know, his degree were from a two-year institution that, you know, one of those diploma mills, they found out. Anyway, they went to the media, this loony group, and telling them, yeah, we got the case and said all this positive stuff. And as soon as we said, no, we're not having nothing more to do with you, because the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization contacted us and said, look, we've got real doctors in our membership, which they did. And they sent those over, get a house call, check me out, and then, you know, brought me into the office for further testing. You know, all that, you know, panned out. They were totally legit, and it was obvious they were. But this other group started, you know, just switched around and started attacking, saying, oh, he was in here and he's out, man, hallucinating on drugs. And that was the big story in the media then. But little did they know that I had blood and urine samples taken with these legitimate doctors who put them through the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's drug screen, which showed no trace of any drug in my body. But what the media wasn't asking, and what the people never thought to ask, was, well, you know, how do seven people have the same hallucination? You know, the whole idea, the first question was, were they drinking? Well, when does alcohol ever make people hallucinate? And when does it ever make seven people have the same hallucination? But then they tried to say I had a transitory psychosis. This one of the psychiatrists that come up with that interviewed me, and he could see that the hypnosis was genuine, and you know, he issued a statement to the media. You know, this is conclusion is absolute. He's not hoaxing. He's not lying. He's been through a traumatic event, but he just couldn't accept the idea of UFOs. You know. And he compared the UFO experience, or my emotional state, to that of, you know, having experienced a death or a divorce or some really, you know, momentous calamity in my recent experience. But since he didn't believe it, he came up with the idea of a transitory psychosis. Went crazy, thought I experienced this, came back to normal. But how do you explain the other six guys? Were they in a transitory psychosis? You know, it just didn't make any sense, and nobody seemed to ask those kind of questions. Then another explanation was the hypnotist, Dr. James Harder with APRO, that he had planted these ideas in my head. But he didn't hypnotize the crew, and they saw what I saw. So, you know, people were desperate to explain it away. And, you know, just the planet Jupiter that was thrown out there, people just, oh, yeah, okay, fine. You know, it's like they were just eager to grab on to something that said this terrible thing can't happen around here. And so that was my battle in the initial months and years to follow, you know, is fighting off these accusations. And you know what? They never die. It's some of this stuff survives to this day on the internet. Things that have been refuted, things that have been disproved by documentation, like medical tests and whatnot, the skeptics still put that out there in kind of a disinformation campaign. Just any way to explain it away. And I've tried to go on these sites that these skeptics maintain, and they'll accept negative comments from the public. But when I go on there and say, look, this is disproven and here's the proof, they won't even let me post. So you can see that they're not interested in revealing this horrible truth. It's propaganda, and they know it. And if it was fair and open, then the evidence that I'm citing and the proof that I give them would be included too. So it was a long, hard battle, and there's a lot that went on. But you know, over the years, a lot of stuff came out over time that. And there's my brother. He passed away February before last, and I really miss him. And I wouldn't have survived those first days after it happened without him. He was at his strongest when I was at my weakest. And I'll always be grateful to him for that. But this is L.J. Lorenz, and he was the director of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. At that time, the oldest and largest UFO investigative group. Good scientists, good doctors and people in their membership. And Jim Lorenzen was also a very scientific person himself. Dr. Harder here, he performed the hypnosis. He was a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And Dr. Leo Sprinkle was the director of counseling and testing at the University of Wyoming. And he reviewed my psychiatric test, which proved there was no transitory psychosis. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, a famous astronomer from Northwestern University, who also met with me and announced to the public that Walton is not hoaxing and that I had been the subject of a lot of unfounded accusations. But the thing that dominated my nightmares for so long afterwards was these eyes, the stare that they gave me in that those few seconds in that standoff there by the operating table. And I think I know what might have caused that. One of the medical tests that I underwent was an EEG, a brain scan. And when they put me in there, this is one of the best brain places in the world, Barrow's Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. But they didn't tell the technician who I was or what I was in there for. I was just looking for some sign of injury. And in his report, he made note of an anomalous pattern that I think may have been the reason that this stare was so disturbing. I think they were trying to gain control of me at that moment. And the reason it was so unbearable was the intensity of their effort, but it wasn't working because of some brain injury that happened because of this energy blast that hit me. And so some of the follow-up research that I plan is to have another brain scan to see if that pattern is still there, to have the original test reviewed by a modern neuroscientist to see if what they can judge to be the reason for that particular pattern. And it would be interesting if it is still there, and if it was the source of my ability to resist their control, you know, it'd be a pretty handy thing to have if I still have it. At least it'd be nice to walk around knowing I had that ability. But again, that was the subject of my nightmares. That was the main thing for quite a long time. Then eventually the dreams were no longer nightmares. They were just dreams, little glimmers of things involving the human-looking ones. But a lot of coincidences occurred in the intervening years, just remarkable things that just make you shake your head. And, you know, coincidence is a coincidence. Maybe it's just chance. But I was looking at this topographical map of the state of Arizona, and it was all divided up into about 75 different areas. But the area where the incident happened was Area 51. And it's just kind of an accident of numbering that is like a whole lot of the coincidences that came to bear in this whole incident. Like Robert Patrick, the one who played the crew boss, turned out his birthday was November 5th, the date that the incident happened. Another coincidence, Robert Patrick turned out to be Mike's cousin, the cousin of the man who's that he's playing. He was actually double cousins, cousins on two sides of the family. So a lot of strange coincidences, but one thing that came to light was we went back to the site for an interview and in 92, leading up to the movie. And I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, part of the reason the place, the exact spot was hard to find wasn't just that we hadn't been there in a long time and that there was so much snow there. It was because the tree growth had changed the look of that particular area. It turned out that later I found out that Mike, the crew boss, went back the following spring after the snow melted and discovered that the trees nearest to where the craft came down had grown much faster than they should have. And so he took a core sample, and this is an example of one of the many trees. The effect was greatest near where the craft came down and kind of faded away as you moved back into the woods, and then it disappeared and all around. But this tree was 85 years old. But counting one ring for each year, going back 15 years, the winter of 1975, you can see that a tree that was 85 years old at that point had doubled in diameter in 15 years. So, you know, the calculation was that this particular tree, at least, and, you know, most of the ones that were close, was producing wood fiber at 36 times the rate that it had before. Well, when I went back there winter before last with National Geographic, we were going to do some follow-up research, and we discovered a stump near Ground Zero, the center of the site, and this tree was cut in the logging operations that were immediately, the year immediately prior to the incident. And yet, here we had a 200-year-old tree. The significance of this discovery was that skeptics were saying, well, maybe there was just wet years right there. Maybe there was just some climate variation that made these trees grow faster. But here, a 200-year-old tree had rings that were had a very uniform amount of variation. And you can see in the earlier tree rings in this sample that you're looking at here that there is some variation, but it's not anything like what occurred after that point. And in this 200-year-old tree, you know, you have a benchmark, a record of the kind of growth conditions right there at that spot on that ridge going back 200 years, and there was no extraordinary variation like you see from 1975 to 92. And that was very exciting for me to discover, but yet National Geographic was turning the whole thing into a big joke. So if you see any kind of UFO-related show by National Geographic, they're not serious. You know, it's, you know, their nature stuff, their science stuff is top rate, top notch, but they don't have any respect for UFO cases. I spent 3 days with them, and they just focused on totally ridiculous stuff. The scientists that they brought with them took samples. I took some samples, fortunately. So it's documented that this 200-year-old benchmark, you know, they witnessed, you know, that this came off of a stump, you know, the, in the ground there. But they never followed up with any of the research that, that we were there for. We were to record and check for the magnetic readings that the scientists had, that the researchers had found at the site during the search, had these real high magnetic readings and a polarity reversal at one side of the clearing. And we wanted to follow up and see if the radiation was still there, but they insisted on going in winter and there was 2 feet of snow on the ground. And then they said, well, water blocks radiation, so we can't do that test. So basically you got a show where this girl's climbing the tree, screaming the whole time. And I still don't know why she was climbing the tree, but I guess they thought that made for interesting film. And then when we left, they put these cameras and these night vision cameras on themselves and started walking around saying, oh, is there bears out there? Well, you know, there's 2 feet of snow because there was no bears, but they said, oh, we better get out of here. And that's how they ended the show. It's just, it was a big ridiculousness. But anyway, so I'm going to be doing some follow-up on research at the site. I'm trying to move along here and cover the, this is a diagram and calculations on the tree growth. And I got a hold of a Freedom of Information Act request on Philip Klass, our UFO skeptic there. The FBI had a file on him. And there's a memo in there. Now you notice that secret and confidential and all that stuff has been X'd out. So this has been released because he, the case is now closed because he's passed on. But I don't think this is the correct document. But there is one memo from J. Edgar Hoover himself to the director of the CIA turning the whole matter over to them. And, you know, it is standard CIA recruiting methods to get something on somebody and then get their cooperation. I don't think it was necessary to bring in the CIA to get Philip Klass to be a UFO skeptic. He was already a skeptic, but they were able to, you know, bankroll and control and guide his efforts probably a little more vigorously than he would have, and maybe bankroll things like $10,000 offers. During the aftermath of the incident, Steve Pierce, the youngest guy on the crew, was brought a message by a local deputy, Click, from Philip Klass, offering him $10,000 to deny that this incident happened, to claim it was a hoax. And Steve never accepted the offer because, you know, he just couldn't bring himself to lie about it, even though he's desperate for the money. But, you know, this FBI file was very interesting because it was sort of the smoking gun on the, was he really a, secretly a government agent? But maybe this is the FBI. No, this is the one to Strategic Air Command. They're holding the case in what is called RUC, remains under consideration or something. So basically they had an axe to hold over his head. But here's some of the quotations from some of the files, you know. Klass is well known to us. This is the FBI talking. He's deficient on all points of his argument, particularly concerning the credentials of Dr. Hynek, which could scarcely be better. On the other hand, Klass has no such sterling reputation and has twice been under FBI connection with the unauthorized publication of classified information. This was in connection with his job at an aerospace magazine. His previous communications generally have been accusatory or argumentative in nature. And then later on, BUFILE, which is an abbreviation for Bureau of FBI File, 62 blah, 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 serial 7, states that in view of Klass's intemperate criticisms and often irrational statements he made to support them, it was recommended that the Bureau be most circumspect in any future contact with him. But, you know, what's really interesting is this next one. BUFILE discloses that Klass has, from time to time, come to our attention by virtue of the fact that he has been in, and then there's 9 lines that are taken out right there. That's a big chunk. and then this bureau, partial line redact, and then this is the key phrase, and not to be of assistance to his government. That's the one where I think that's suggestive that they are trying to recruit him. But since the classified information could not be declassified for purposes of prosecution, no action was taken. But we know that's kind of a lame excuse not to prosecute. Otherwise, you'd never be able to prosecute anybody for releasing classified information if you couldn't discuss it in court. You know, that'd let everybody off. And then, like I said, RUC status. So they held that over his head, in my view. But anyway, a lot of interesting stuff in connection with this government disinformationist stuff. There was a call that came in right before the release of the movie. This guy said that he was deer hunting in the area at the time that it happened, and he was with his wife, who he's now divorced from. And even though, you know, she's divorced, he would back up what he was saying, that they were on the next ridge and that they saw the glow of the craft and the beam. And that at that time, and I didn't think anything out of the ordinary when he first told me this, that he was in the military. He was in military intelligence. You know, it should have been ringing alarm bells, you know. What is somebody with military intelligence coincidentally being the only deer hunter close enough to see this incident from the next ridge? He said that he went to his superior officers and asked him if he should come forward. These men were accused of murder. And so his superior said, unless they're actually indicted, stay out of it. And so he never did say anything. He said he always regretted not coming forward to corroborate, you know, and report what he'd seen. So I called Tracy Torme, the screenwriter on the movie, told him about this. I just thought it would be interesting for them to hear from him. And so I went off and was doing these interviews to help promote the movie. And I found out later that they contacted this guy, flew him out to Hollywood, interviewed him there, and then they decided to give him a polygraph test. And so the state police polygraph examiner that had tested the crew was now in private practice, so they went to him and had him tested. And sure enough, he passed the test that he had been there, that he was in military intelligence, that he had seen the glow of the craft and the flash of the beam. But when they questioned him on another test, asking if he had any connection to Philip Klass and the disinformationists, boom, he flunked that one as badly as he passed as extremely as he passed the first one. So that was very curious. And this happened right before we were to be on Larry King, where you saw him across from us. And that was as close as I ever got to having any sort of contact or communication. I never spoke directly to Philip Klass on that show. He wasn't even in the same studio. They piped him in from another room, separate from us. Maybe they had feared some sort of violent reaction, but for whatever reason, he wasn't anywhere near us and didn't speak directly to me, and I didn't speak to him either. So he never, in all the time that he wrote parts of several books and dozens of papers that he sent out to the media and all around, never made any attempt to contact me, never called me, never wrote a letter or anything. Very curious when he's putting huge pressure on Mike Rogers, attempting to bribe Steve Pierce. Why are they being harassed by the government and not me? It's just something anybody got any ideas? I don't know. It seems like if they were going to try to trip you up or discredit you, they would try to talk to me and just get me to say anything that he could misquote. And that was one of his favorite tactics, to take something and then twist it around and make it sound like you said something you didn't. So, real curious, but and it's ongoing. Mike says that to this day, federal officers are harassing him in various ways. A lot of new stuff coming up all the time, digging up. But I'm really interested in hearing from you, because I know you've got a lot of questions, and that'll help kind of hit on some points that I haven't covered yet, because there's a lot of material. So let's hear a question. Well, you know, the question is, did they communicate telepathically? And if they were attempting to communicate telepathically, it was not working. Because either because of my injury or because of my hysteria and my fear, or maybe that they didn't want to, you know, because it seemed in many ways like they were trying to keep to an absolute minimum the amount that I could learn about them, at least during that conscious period. Maybe I learned more and they weren't worried about that part because eventually they were able to, you know, that's something I hadn't thought of, you know. If the rest of that memory is blocked, how'd they do that? You know, something must have, they must have used some other method to do that. Why once, you know, the other conscious period during those 5 days is totally blocked, so you have to have some method of doing that. But nothing, no two-way communication. It was all one way, me screaming and them not answering. So another question, he's going to bring a microphone out. And so
we're going to bring the microphones out to you when you raise your hand because we're being covered by live radio tonight. So the audience on the radio would like to hear the questions. So
I have the mic, I'm going to ask two questions and if you can answer them. Did you get a feeling or do you, is it your opinion that they were hostile or did you ever feel like they were in any way friendly to you or were they trying to do harm or was it more of a...
You know, part of my negative impression about my reaction to the little humanoids was the seeming lack of emotion or expression. It wasn't, their faces weren't frozen like a mask or anything, but at the same time, it wasn't friendly and it wasn't hostile. It was just dispassionate. You know, whenever you're around another person and you feel that they're completely indifferent to you, not hostile, but not friendly, we all have a tendency to kind of interpret that as a hostile situation. But all the other things about feeling trapped, claustrophobic, the pain, you know, not being able to breathe, that had more to do with my negative reaction than anything. And the human-looking ones, they never seemed aggressive or hostile in their movements or expressions. Like I said, the expression was more slight annoyance, maybe, you know, a slight smile, you know, but real faint expressions, but nothing that seemed hostile or mean at all. And it's in hindsight that I figure the whole reason they took me was because I was injured, and that was really my fault. You know, I was so resentful about that what happened, and, you know, I called it an abduction because everybody else called it that. It's only in more recent years that rather than abduction, I think maybe we ought to call it an ambulance call. Because when I rose up, that was the point at which my head and chest were closest to the object. And I think that there was some kind of energy field building up. You know, when Mike said it seemed like something was about to happen, I think they were feeling this static electrical feeling building up in the air. And then when I rose up, this energy discharged through me and accidentally caused cardiac arrest or worse, you know, and that then they had to bring me on board to revive me because the nearest hospital was an hour away. And if they had tried that, it would have been too late. You got 4 to 6 minutes to start the heart or it's permanent. So the fact that I was returned at all, the fact that I was brought to a place where I could get help, all of that suggests that it was kind of more benign than I first thought.
Thank you. The second part of my question, and I'll just I have a family member who had an encounter of the first kind. I think that's what they call it. But would you agree with his opinion that because several people come up missing all the time, that there may be several abductions that are not necessarily, you know, by other people, but maybe through because of these alien beings that are abducting people? What can you say about that?
Well, I'm reluctant to conclude that there's evil intent in being so advanced I would like to think that by the time we get that far, that we'll be far beyond those kinds of malevolent things. But, you know, even in my area, there's been a number of disappearances, not necessarily known to be connected to, you know, a UFO sighting. But, you know, in one case, a lady that was well known in the community, worked at the post office, just came up missing. Her car was in the driveway, screen door was closed, but the door was open, the TV was on. She was just gone. No sign of a struggle, no sign of a robbery, no sign of anything. She just never was seen again. You know, they had her picture on a billboard there in town for a long time, her picture in the post office. But there was a number of other disappearances. There was one case where a truck driver was driving a load of strawberries in a refrigerated truck, and he drove back up into the forest. And the people there said that he got out and was acting strangely. He said, "What are you doing here with this truckload of stuff back in the woods?" You know, and he says, "They made me do it." But nobody ever figured out who they was. But he was never seen again. There's trucks sitting there. His wife said his favorite hat was still in the truck. And, you know, the whole area is, you know, got hikers and hunters that cover every square inch of that ground. And nobody ever saw him again. So what was going on there? Who knows? You know, I need to look into that. But I think that probably in some cases, you know, if they were taken by these beings, it's entirely possible that they may have just volunteered to stay or found it necessary. There may have been some medical condition that they had to stay in order to live, you know, and there might have been sort of a rescue for them, who knows. But, you know, that's all speculation. I just don't know. My own impression of the beings that I encountered wasn't malevolent. That doesn't guarantee any kind of safety in this situation. It's just my own personal impression.
Yes, sir. Mr. Walton?
Yes.
Since the incident happened, there's been a lot of people who have claimed multiple abductions despite moving around different places in the country. Did you ever have any concern or fear that you might still be of interest to these beings?
I had a lot of fear and concern about that, especially at first, but I've gotten past that.
Mr. Walden, What was your worldview before your encounter with these entities and during, and then how has it changed to now?
Well, that's a huge question, but, you know, I guess I'd have to say my worldview is a lot narrower than it was afterwards. It definitely broadened my perspective about things, our place in the universe. You know, I had to do a lot of thinking to try to come to terms with this, you know. What's going on here? Who's in charge? You know, who are these so-called experts? You know, people that you would think at the top of the authority situation, you know, scientists, people making pronouncements that I know for a fact aren't true. So it really pointed up to me and drove home the idea that I got to do my thinking for myself, you know. And I recommend this to everybody, you know. Do your own thinking. There is no ultimate source of, you know, truth anywhere. You know, you're going to find it in bits and pieces, not any kind of a package deal with anybody.
Hi, I just had a quick question. I was wondering, when you got hit by the laser beam, if you've had any scars from it, or if you had any scars from after the incident.
You know, right after I was returned, you know, they commented on that, the shell-shocked, look I had, you know. People were really struck by the the look in my eyes. But it wasn't due to any real injury. It was just the psychological state I was in. It was just totally, you know, blown away. Kind of PTSD is what they call it now. They didn't have that term back then.
You said that you had a pattern of some sort when they were looking at your eyes, right?
That I had a what?
A pattern when they gave you the test?
Well, the brainwave scan.
Yeah.
Well, let me try to remember just exactly what they said. It was a bisynchronous alternating pattern moving from front to back. What that means, I have no idea. The technician thought it was significant enough to write into the report. That was the anomaly that he pointed out. And that's what I'm going to look into, taking that report to another brain scientist to see what he thinks of it and to have the test repeated to see if it's that pattern's still there.
Do you think you were born with it, or did you receive it when you
got Excellent question. See, you get good ones from these young guys. Nobody's ever asked that. What if it was always there? What if that led them to single me out like Steve thinks, you know? I don't know. That's something that never occurred to me.
Mr. Walton?
Yeah.
Based on your when you said that you saw a touchscreen in your in the chair in the ship?
Yeah.
On the technology you saw there, is it similar to modern technology we have now, or we're not even close to scratching the surface based on what you witnessed?
Was what similar?
The technology in the ship, similar to the technology we have now today.
Knobs? Is that what you said?
Yeah, like any technology.
Oh, the controls. No, that the handle on there was, it was kind of way too small for my hand, but I could still move it, you know. It seemed like it was like molded for the hand, and that upper part rotated independent from the lever that was supporting it. I don't know what hooked it to it, because it seemed like it could roll independent of the lever itself. But otherwise, you know, the buttons just seemed like lighted buttons. You know, you'd think there'd be something real high-tech or something, but like I said, I never touched the screen to see if that moved anything.
I have a question about the diagram you had of the inside of the ship. As you came out of the room where you were challenging the people with something and then went into that corridor, it looks like you began a circle that was counterclockwise.
Right.
Is that how it felt to you?
Yeah, it was curving to my right and I was traveling clockwise, yeah.
Oh, clockwise, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Walton, do you feel you were singled out or chosen in any way?
Well, like I said, Alan and Steve think that they were waiting there and that they just wanted me for some reason. But I guess I have a personal bias in preferring to believe it was just a kind of an unexpected thing that happened because I was so impulsive as to get myself too close. I don't know. You know, it's not impossible that they singled me out or had some kind of plan, but, you know, I guess what my personal bias is that if it was just random, something that I caused, then it's less likely to be something that's going to happen again. But I guess it could have been something that they intended for some reason.
After 5 days, were you hungry or had you lost weight?
Yeah. I had quite a bit of weight loss, and I was weighed immediately on the bathroom scales at my mother's house right afterwards. And then when I went in for my medical exam, I brought those scales, and they were compared to the doctor's scale, and they were almost right on. So, you know, the weight loss that I experienced that only took a matter of, you know, a couple of days or, you know, just hours, you know, was restored back to my original weight pretty quickly, suggests that it had more to do with dehydration than starvation. And I really was very thirsty, drank a lot of water, so whatever they were doing to maintain my condition, I was water deficient when I was returned. There may have been a purpose in that. It might not have been an accident. But for whatever reason, I wasn't starved, but I was dehydrated.
Hi. With all the scientific and technological advances that have been made over the years, have you found that in recounting your experience, has it been met with less or more skepticism?
More skepticism from outside about my case.
Right.
I'd say that over time, skepticism has gone down because many of the theories that were thrown out there have been disproven. You know, it's been a long battle, but good solid documentation
In my book, I go and take every single allegation that the skeptics made one by one and demonstrate why it cannot be that way. And, you know, with sources that people can, you know, verify for themselves. So a lot has improved over time. Back then, there was no kind of support group, nowhere to turn. And we didn't know of a single planet outside of the solar system. And now they've got actual evidence, NASA and these telescopes that have put into space, that have identified quite a number of planets outside the solar system, to the point where there's so many of them that NASA said this last year that it's now a virtual certainty that there are more planets in the Milky Way than there are stars. And we already know there's billions of stars. So that's a huge leap forward. And if you've got hundreds of thousands or millions of planets, and you know they can actually establish some kind of a ratio there of how many of those are Earth-like planets, the idea that this Earth-like planet's the only one with any intelligent life on it is just ridiculous at this point, you know? Just common sense tells you we can't be alone, but the people who insist until we absolutely know that there is something from the point of view of scientists, then it's... See, these kind of people think whatever isn't yet proven is the exact equivalent of disproven, and that's just kind of ridiculous because there are many things that we pretty much take for granted that we can't prove in that absolute sense. Anyway, I digress.
Did you or do you still manifest any side effects since your experience?
No, nothing negative. Maybe some lasting effects, but nothing negative.
Mr. Walton, I have a question for you. If you had a mulligan and an opportunity to do it over again, would you do it? And if so, what would you have done differently?
Well, you know, I used to answer that question with, I'd stay in the truck. That always got a laugh, but, you know, that's what I felt at the time. But now, if there was some way I could find out the really nagging questions and get an answer without drawing any additional attention to myself, or I might take the opportunity, but not necessarily go public about it. Right now, you know, I feel that along with the burden of having had this happen to me, that comes a certain responsibility to try to, you know, turn it into some kind of good. And not certain where that's going to take me, but, you know, for now, I'm at least sort of giving people a perspective on how to look at this situation.
Did the medical examinations reveal or conclude any chemical or neurological anomalies, or such as an organic transmitter?
No, nothing was detected. I had upper body x-rays. One person, there was, the doctor found what he described as a 2 millimeter red spot on the inside of, I think it would be my right arm. And that fueled all this talk about a drug hallucination. But people don't inject hallucinogens that I know of. And the doctor said it wasn't over any major blood vessel. And it could have easily been an injury that happened at work. You know, we're working in brush and some of it's got thorns on it. And when the chain on the chainsaw hits it, it'll just, instead of cutting it, it just whips it back at you and it'll poke you. So, you know, it was only 5 days after working in the woods and it could have happened then because the doctor described it as partially healed. So, someone called up and said, well, just get a real powerful magnet and put it over that spot and see what happens. And I did, and I didn't feel anything. And, you know, you can rub that area and you can't feel anything. So, also, it probably would have showed up in the x-ray that the doctor did, and there was nothing there. So, next question.
I'm sure you've been asked this question several times before, but how did this incident affect your spiritual faith before and afterwards?
Well, I don't think it really changed it. And I get questions about the religious angle a lot. But I've been approached by people from quite a few different religions on both sides of the question, Muslim, Mormon, Catholic, and I've heard both. Oh, this can't be true. This contradicts my religion. Or, yeah, this I know this is true because this agrees with my religion. So I think people kind of sell God short if they think, you know, because the Bible doesn't specifically mention beings from out there, at least they think it doesn't, that therefore there can't be anything else. But truth is, there's probably about 7 billion different religions on Earth, one for each of us. because what the deal is that people tend to interpret the scripture of their particular religion in a personal sort of way that may not have anything to do with the actual teachings. I've had people say this contradicts my religion, it can't be true, and this one and I say it confirms it. So I don't think that it necessarily says anything in that regard. In my own personal belief system, I think that religion is less important than spirituality. Religion being, in my definition, it's kind of an organized, earth-based sort of organization, and spirituality being more about our relationship with those kinds of truths and our understanding of them. So I don't consider myself a religious person, but I think that I am spiritual.
Mr. Walton, I have encountered a lot of things in life also. There's been some twins that I know right now, they're like in high school. They never did want to see my entity head. I have an extraterrestrial, which is petrified already. And heaven knows how long it's been here, this earth. And I do believe your testimony, because there's been a lot of testimonies brought forward, just because when I tell them they want to see my extraterrestrial head, they kind of like freak out and they don't want to know anything about that. So what's your opinion on things like that?
In regard to
entities,
my opinion in regard to that, could you repeat that part of the question, please?
In regard to entities, extraterrestrials,
My opinion in regard to the entities, what opinion? Their intention, malevolent? What do you mean? Oh, yeah, well. You know, the people here are people that I believe probably would not be too damaged were the existence of these other beings on these other planets to be openly acknowledged and you know, officially recognized. It wouldn't affect us negatively. You know, that's the reason we're here. But the world at large, I think it would. I mean, look at the wars that are already being made over political and religious and all these different and financial things. All that would be extremely disrupted. You know, people who have millions and billions of dollars at stake, and all that would change and there would be havoc. So it's, you know, the awareness has to come very gradually and we have to adapt as we go along. So for that reason, there may be a similar motive on the part of our governments and on these entities for sort of metering out the amount of evidence that we're getting as time goes on. More and more people are aware of the reality of this gradually, and more and more acknowledgement from various Earth governments. We're going to take 2 more questions, and then I can answer more questions out there. So whoever's passing the mic, get somebody that we haven't heard from.
Have you gone under any kind of hypnosis to maybe recall those 5 days and what happened to you during those 5 days?
Well, I showed you a picture of Dr. Harder. He performed the hypnosis that happened in the days right after it happened. But that didn't really bring out any new memories. The main thing that was accomplished there was for the first time to allow me to set that fear aside and relate the entire events that I recalled up to that point. Didn't add any memories. It just got rid of the fear. And there was a threat about the danger of trying to push through the block on that other 5 days. And I have been reluctant to pursue that. So I haven't done any further hypnosis after that.
And here's the last question.
Okay. If I may ask, you were gone for 5 days, and in the movie it shows that they did some medical exams, maybe, like they put something in your right ear, then they were doing something to your right eye, and then they put some kind of a probe in your mouth or throat. Do you recall or do you remember any other things that they might have done to you while you were gone?
Well, truth is, I don't recall any of those things actually happening. When I backed up against that shelf and I saw all those instruments, I had some really horrific imaginings about what might have been going on, because at that time I thought maybe it was medical experimentation. It's only over the years that I come to realize it might have been more about resuscitation. So, you know, all those fears I had about what they might have done with those instruments were made into the movie, but none of that, you know, was happened while I was conscious. And so I don't know what kind of procedures that were going on. Most likely it was just something done to revive me. So I'll be out to my table here in a bit. If you would like to ask some more questions, I'm all out of posters, but I do have a few books left. Thank you very much for listening. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Walton. Thank you very much.
Thank you.